The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article is from The Culture and News. Prince Harry and Duchess Meghan were involved in a near catastrophic car chase with paparazzi. After the Duchess of Sussex accepted an award at last night's Women of Vision Awards in New York City, she, husband Prince Harry, and her mother, Doria Ragland, were involved in a near-catastrophic car chase with paparazzi. A spokesperson for the Duke and Duchess of Sussex released a statement regarding the incident, denouncing the paparazzi's relentless pursuit of Meghan and Harry. Last night, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex and Mrs. Ragland were involved in a near-catastrophic car chase at the hands of a ring of highly aggressive paparazzi, the statement reads. This relentless pursuit, lasting over 2 hours, resulted in multiple near collisions involving other drivers on the road, pedestrians, and two NYPD officers. While being a public figure comes with a level of interest from the public, it should never come at the cost of anyone's safety. Dissemination of these images, given the ways in which they were obtained, encourages a highly intrusive practice that is dangerous to all involved. A source tells Bizarre.com the chase allegedly included half a dozen blacked-out vehicles, with these drivers committing various traffic violations, such as running red lights, reversing down a one-way street, driving on the sidewalk, blocking a moving vehicle, and driving while using the phone and photographing. The couple was staying at a friend's private residence and did not want to compromise this friend's home. The source also tells Bizarre.com that the Duke and Duchess accept the level of attention they receive at highly publicized events. In the case of last night's ceremony, they allowed paparazzi to capture photos of them entering and leaving the venue. Harry and Meghan have long spoken out against the invasive breaches of privacy that paparazzi and tabloids commit to sell photos and stories about the couple's personal lives. The Duke and Duchess have previously taken legal action, filing multiple lawsuits against the likes of Associated newspapers. In his memoir, Spare, Harry recalled the trauma of losing his mother, Princess Diana, in a fatal car crash in Paris after she was pursued by paparazzi in 1997. Harry wrote that he later drove through the tunnel where the crash occurred when he was 23. We zipped ahead, went over the lip of the tunnel's entrance, the bump that supposedly sent Mummy's Mercedes veering off course. But the lip was nothing. We barely felt it, he wrote. As the car entered the tunnel, I leaned forward, watched the light change to a kind of water orange, watched the concrete pillars flicker past. I counted them, counted my heartbeats, and in a few seconds we emerged from the other side. I sat back. Quietly I said, "Is that all of it?" "It's nothing. Just a straight tunnel." I'd always imagined the tunnel was some treacherous passageway, inherently dangerous, but it was just a short, simple, no-frills tunnel. No reason anyone should ever die inside. Our next article is still in the Culture and News section of Oprah. Former President Barack Obama discusses gun violence in a new CBS morning interview. Former President Barack Obama discussed gun violence in America with CBS Morning's co-host, Nate Burleson, in an exclusive interview that aired today. As CBS News reports, there have been more than 200 mass shootings in America in 2023 alone, a staggering number, as President Obama observed. We are unique among advanced developed nations in tolerating, on a routine basis, gun violence in the form of shootings, mass shootings, suicides, Obama told CBS. In Australia, you had one mass shooting 50 years ago, and they said, "Oh, we're not doing that anymore." That's normally how you would expect a society to respond when your children are at risk. But Obama thinks investing in America's youth is part of the solution. Even in the absence of action at the federal level, you are still seeing communities able to reduce violence by dealing with not just access to guns, but just as importantly, making sure that the young people in these communities feel as if they've got somebody who's paying attention to them, he explained. On the same note, Obama also told Burleson about an updated initiative from an Obama Foundation program called My Brother's Keepers Alliance. The former president first unveiled a new MBK, Model Communities Initiative, on May 10th, sharing that four cities were selected for the program: Newark, New Jersey, Yonkers, New York, Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Omaha, Nebraska. Obama originally created MBK in 2014 to address persistent opportunity gaps facing boys and young men of color and to ensure all youth can reach their full potential. The interview also features heartwarming moments from Obama and Burleson's time spent with some young men in the program. Tune in to the whole conversation above to learn about the gravest concern former President Obama has after leaving office, while he believes in the power of America's youth, and more. Continuing on in culture and news, at 81, Martha Stewart is on the cover of Sports Illustrated's swimsuit edition, and she's seriously fit. Martha Stewart makes 81 look incredibly chic and super fun. The entrepreneur and TV personality landed on the cover of this year's Sports Illustrated swimsuit edition, and the photos are legit everything. She posed in a white one-piece swimsuit, and everything about her looks fiercely strong and glowy. To stay as fit as she is, Martha works out every single day. "I find it's where I can get my mind in the right place for the day ahead," she said. Martha Stewart has been feeling herself lately, and with good reason. She makes 81 look amazing. Well, given how fab and strong she's been looking, it shouldn't be a shock then that the entrepreneur and TV personality landed in this year's Sports Illustrated swimsuit edition. Sports Illustrated hasn't released the official photos yet, but influencer Evan Ross Katz just shared them on Instagram, and she looks next level. There's Stewart with bombshell hair posing in a white one-piece suit with her toned legs on full display. Stewart making a kissy face at the camera in a silver bathing suit and oversized sunnies. Stewart back in that white one-piece with her hair blowing around as she gives the camera a knowing smile, and Stewart hanging under a spray of water in that silver suit. In what might be the serve of the century, Martha Stewart, lensed by Ruvan Afanador for the 2023 Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue, Katz wrote in the caption, and people totally freaked. "She has built an entire career based on serving," one said, while someone else joked, "It her DMs going crazy." Stewart has joked about being a thirst trap and fair, but how does she get so strong? She shared on her website that she prioritizes working out, and she does it every day after having a glass of green juice and a cappuccino. "To feel my best no matter how busy I am, I exercise each morning," she said. "Before the pandemic, I worked with a yoga teacher and a trainer, but now I do it alone, and I admit it's been difficult. Getting up early to start the day in an empty gym is never fun." Stewart said that her home gym is equipped with weights and the latest machines, including a Peloton bike, a tonal system, and a DB machine for her lower body. "Working out helps her to get her day started right," she said, adding, "I find it's where I can get my mind in the right place for the day ahead." Like everyone, Stewart struggles with motivation sometimes. "There are some mornings when I don't feel like exercising, but I do it anyway, and I'm so glad afterward. I always feel refreshed and energized," she said. Also in the mix, Pilates. Stewart shared a breakdown of her wellness secrets in the comments of an Instagram post in April, after someone hilariously wrote, "What are you doing? How are you looking this amazing?" Stewart replied with this: "Eating very well, Pilates 3 times a week, horseback riding at least once a week, no smoking, little drinking, green juice daily." Stewart did a What I Eat in a Day video for Harper's Bazaar in 2021 and was clear that she's a clean eater. "I want organic, I want clean, I want tasty, and I want healthy," she said, nothing that a lot of what she eats is from her own farm. Stewart said she's not into snacking and tends to have a light lunch of canned tuna mixed with fresh celery, crispy apple, half of a shallot, lemon juice, a little mayo, and salt and pepper. She also said she keeps bare-bones ingredients on hand, like good Parmesan cheese, really good organic milk, lots of good butter, creme fraichée for omelets, and fresh eggs from her chickens. Sometimes she'll even have homemade bagels, because Martha Stewart. Next article is Dwayne "The Rock" Johnson shares how he struggled with depression throughout his life. Over the years, Dwayne Johnson has always been on hand to help people with their physical health, offering workouts, fitness advice, and inspiration through his IG channel. Now, during a recent appearance on The Pivot, the Black Adam star has attempted to help people with their mental health, too. During the interview, Johnson shared his own struggles with mental ill health, recounting 3 bouts of depression, as well as later posting a moving caption alongside a clip from the recording. "Years ago, I didn't know what mental health struggle was," Johnson wrote in his IG caption. "As men, we didn't talk about it. We just kept our head down and worked through it. Not healthy, but it's all we knew. I lost 2 friends to suicide. Talk to someone. Despite how you may feel, you're never alone." This isn't the first time Johnson has opened up about his experiences with depression and has admitted that he's worked hard over the years to gain the emotional tools to manage his struggles. He's previously shared how his mother's suicide attempt affected him. On The Pivot, he recalled how his first interaction with depression came while he was a student at the University of Miami in Florida. "The interesting thing at that time," Johnson said, "is I just didn't know what it was. I didn't know what mental health was. I didn't know what depression was." Johnson went on to share details about 2 other low or gray times in his life. "Years later, went through it again when I got a divorce. Didn't know what it was. Years later, around 2017, went through it a little bit, but I knew what it was at that time, and luckily I had some friends I could lean on and say, 'Hey, I'm feeling a little wobbly, got a little struggle happening, and I'm seeing the gray and not the blue,'" said Johnson. Having people to lean on is one way Johnson deals with his low moments in his life. His other saving grace is his 3 daughters and being a girl dad, because he said, "You look at them and you realize this is what it's all about." In TV and movies, this article is entitled, "Bridgerton's Queen Charlotte Was a Real Royal, and She May Have Been the First Black British Monarch." Aside from the scene-stealing Simone Duke of Hastings, Reggae Jane Page, and our heroine Daphne Phoebe Denivore, not to mention the disembodied voice of Julie Andrews, one of our favorite characters of Shondaland's Bridgerton is the gossip-loving Queen Charlotte. From her icy stare and commanding presence to her over-the-top wigs and unapologetically opulent gowns, we can never thank showrunner Chris Van Dusen enough for adding her character, played by Golda Rashuel, to the romantic drama, particularly seeing as Queen Charlotte, who was a real monarch of the Regency era from 1761 to 1818, was not in the Julia Quinn book series the show is adapted from. And now the royal has her very own spin-off series, the majority of which are penned by Shonda Rhimes herself. Queen Charlotte, A Bridgerton Story, is available to stream on Netflix now. In this prequel, India Armatefio stars as a young version of Queen Charlotte as she meets and marries King George, played by Corey Mailchrist. Additionally, Rochevelle is returning to play Queen Charlotte along with Bridgerton's Ajoa Ando and Ruth Gimmel, who play Lady Dunbury and Violet Bridgerton, respectively. Queen Charlotte opened up an entirely new world for us, Van Dusen tells Oprah Daily about the series, which takes place in 1813 London. What really struck me with the books from the beginning is that this was an opportunity to marry history and fantasy in a really exciting, interesting way. So in Queen Charlotte, that was the history. And then it was thinking of these fantastical scenes and situations to put her in that were really fun to write, too. For Quinn, the royal was a welcome addition to the Bridgerton universe, confessing to Oprah Daily that she even wrote a fan letter to Rochevelle after seeing her performance. "I go back and forth between wishing I had actually written her in the books and then being glad I didn't, because I don't know if I could have done as good a job," Quinn says. What was intriguing to the writer was the debate among historians over whether or not the real Queen Charlotte was black. One particular researcher has tracked the royal's genealogy and believes he's found evidence that she was. Despite peers contesting his findings, Quinn looked into how that influenced the world of the Netflix series. "I don't think it's ever going to be proven or disproven, to be honest with you," Quinn says. "But let's say she was black. And what if that was accepted at the time and people acknowledged that, and then she used that position to lift other people of color to higher positions in society? What would society look like?" Ahead, we explore the life of the real Queen Charlotte that inspired the Bridgerton character. Queen Charlotte had 15 children. Queen Charlotte was born Sophia Charlotte of Mecklenburg-Strelitz to a German duke and princess on May 19, 1744. She became Queen of Great Britain and Ireland after marrying King George III in London in September 1761. The young royal was 17 at the time, while her husband was 22. According to the royal family's official website, the couple wed just 6 hours after Charlotte arrived in England, and they met for the first time. Despite only brief mentions of kids in Bridgerton, the real Queen Charlotte gave birth to 15 children, with 13 surviving until adulthood. As mentioned in a dinner conversation between the Queen and King in Episode 5's The Duke and I, their youngest child, Princess Amelia, died at age 27 in 1810, just 3 years before Bridgerton takes place. However, their 13th and 14th children, Prince Octavius and Prince Alfred, died at ages 4 and 1, respectively. Queen Charlotte may have been the first black British royal. The theory that Queen Charlotte may be the first mixed-race or black British royal begins with a genealogical research of historian Mario Duvaldez y Cocom, who began his studies in 1967, according to the Washington Post. Queen Charlotte, 1744 to 1818, wife of the English King George III, 1738 to 1820, was directly descended from Margarita de Castro y Souza, a black branch of the Portuguese royal house, Valdez wrote for PBS's Frontline. According to the Washington Post, Valdez says that the Portuguese royal Alfonso III's mistress, Urana, that's O-U-R-U-A-N-A, was a black Moor. He pointed to Charlotte's physician using the outdated and offensive term mulatto to describe her appearance. He also said a prime minister depicted her in a racist manner by describing stereotypical features, writing, "Her nose is too wide and her lips too thick." Valdez also observed various portraits of Queen Charlotte, noting they featured the royal with a darker skin tone and curly hair. Six different lines can be traced from English Queen Charlotte back to Margarita de Castro y Souza in a gene pool which, because of royal inbreeding, was already minuscule, thus explaining the Queen's unmistakable African appearance, he wrote. The characteristics of the Queen's portraits certainly had political significance, since artists of that period were expected to play down, soften, or even obliterate undesirable features in a subject's face. Despite Valdez's research, that features outdated and offensive language, other historians dispute his findings. The word blackamoor in Shakespeare's time meant Muslim. University of Pennsylvania professor Anya Lumba told the Philadelphia Inquirer, it didn't mean black necessarily. Moors could be white from North Africa. As for the palace's thoughts on the matter, a spokesperson told the Boston Globe, this has been rumored for years and years. It's a matter of history, and frankly, we've got far more important things to talk about. Queen Charlotte's husband, King George III, grappled with mental illness. In Bridgerton, despite the unflappable, regal exterior she shows to the public, we get a glimpse into Queen Charlotte's private life as she deals with the progressive decline of her husband, King George III's mental state. As it turns out, Queen Charlotte and King George III were a doting couple whose first 25 years of marriage were spent happily, according to the historic Royal Palace's website. However, more than two decades after his first bout of mental illness, that was kept hidden from the Queen. In 1788, King George III experienced a months-long manic episode that left him unable to fulfill his royal duties. This was the first of a series of instances of illnesses across the next 32 years that earned him the infamously tasteless title, the Mad King, and permanently fractured his and his wife's close relationship. The king succumbed to mania in 1811, which meant their oldest son George, the Prince of Wales, became regent until his father's death in 1820. Charlotte was loyal to her husband and acted as his guardian until her own death in 1818, according to the royal family's website. For years, it was theorized that a genetic blood disorder called porphyria caused King George III's mental decline. This idea is depicted in the 1994 film The Madness of King George, starring Helen Mirren and Nigel Hawthorne. But modern research rejects this diagnosis, with the BBC reporting in 2013 that doctors found many of the king's symptoms mimicked someone experienced the manic phase of psychiatric illness, such as bipolar disorder. The character of Charlotte's nephew, Prince Friedrich of Prussia, was based on a real person. One of the many obstacles that blocked Daphne and Simone's path to happiness was the dashing Prince Friedrich. After declaring her the diamond of the season, Bridgerton's Queen Charlotte pushed her Prussian nephew to court Daphne. But was he a real person too? Well, it appears as though the character was based on the little-known Prince Friedrich Wilhelm Ludwig of Prussia, according to Sotheby's. He's lived from 1794 to 1863 and was an esteemed soldier. His parents were Prince Louis Charles of Prussia and Duchess Frederica of Mecklenburg-Strelitz, the eventual Queen of Hanover, who was both the niece and daughter-in-law of Queen Charlotte, after marrying the Queen's eighth child, Ernest Augustus, King of Hanover, and though he did not marry Daphne in the show, in real life he wed Princess Louise of Anhalt-Bernburgen in 1817. They had two sons. As Bridgerton shows, Queen Charlotte truly did discover Mozart. King George III was the founder of the Royal Academy of Arts, and he and Queen Charlotte bonded over their shared passion for music. She was an accomplished harpsichord player, and if you remember in Episode 2's Shock and Delight, Rocheville's Queen Charlotte confidently declares to Violet Bridgerton, "I became acquainted with Mr. Mozart when he was not 10 years old. The boy accompanied me as I sang on an aria, and I declared then and there that he should become one of the finest composers in Europe." This is true. The Royal Collection Trust says, in 1764, an 8-year-old Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart performed for the royals during a visit to England, while Olwen Headley's biography about the Queen confirms that Charlotte sang while the young musical genius played the organ. A year later, Mozart dedicated his Opus 3 to Charlotte and would go on to dedicate 6 sonatas to her. A few other fun facts about the royal. As we see in the show, she was particularly fond of Pomeranians throughout her life and would often give them as gifts to friends. Plus, her husband purchased what we know as London's Buckingham Palace. The family moved into the home in 1762, and it quickly became a favorite property of Charlotte's and was called the Queen's House, according to the royal family website. As a country escape for her and her daughters, the monarch bought Windsor's Frogmore House and commissioned the build of Frogmore Cottage on the property in 1801. That name may sound familiar because it's the much-talked-about home that was formerly rented by Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, but eventually turned over to Princess Eugenie and her husband Jack Brooksbank. After 57 years on the throne, Queen Charlotte died in 1818 at the age of 74. She is buried at St. George's Chapel. Okay, we're over in the work and money section. What is a bullet journal and how to get started? What is a bullet journal? Whether you need to get a better handle on your to-do list or want an outlet to help you relax, a bullet journal can help. But what exactly is a bullet journal? Think of it as a next-level diary for not only writing but also drawing. Instead of blank-lined pages, a bullet journal, or bujo for short, contains sections to log daily to-dos, keep a monthly or weekly calendar, jot down notes, track both physiological and mental health, and record both short and long-term goals. How to make a bullet journal. Here's the catch. A bullet journal isn't something you buy already templated. Instead, you purchase a blank or dot grid journal and create something unique to you and your goals. Because of that, starting a bullet journal does require a rather significant upfront time investment. The process should be fun and creative, though. A great addition to any self-care routine. Besides a few simple sticking points like an index and a calendar, the contents of your journal and just how involved you make it is entirely up to you. Don't let the time of the year throw you off either. There's no need to wait until next January. You can start a bullet journal in the beginning, middle, or end of the year, or any time in between. Remember, much like creating a vision board, there aren't many hard and fast rules to bullet journaling. Ready to get started? Follow the step-by-step guide for beginners by calligrapher and illustrator Kimberly Schreck. Step 1. Gather everything you need. You don't have to splurge on an arsenal of supplies. To get started with a bullet journal, you really need only 2 things, a dot grid notebook and a no-bleed pen. Look for a journal with a lay-flat spine, high-quality paper, and a dot grid that's light and easy on the eyes and numbered pages. When it comes to pens, dual tips, pens with a bullet tip on one end and a brush on the other, are most versatile. But if you want to use your bullet journal as an opportunity to be creative, go for it. Stock up on colored gel pencils, watercolors, stickers. The sky's the limit, really. The bottom line, you're more likely to stick with the project if it feels manageable and inspiring, and that will look slightly different for everyone. Step 2. Think about what purpose your bullet journal will serve. A bullet journal can be a calendar, to-do list, a goal tracker, and a diary all in one. But it doesn't have to be all those things. Before you put pen to paper, consider how your bullet journal can best serve you. As a mom and a small business owner, the purpose of my bullet journal is to stay ahead of my ever-growing to-do list, says Shrek. I use mine to keep track of all household appointments and to-dos, as well as appointments, stats, and ideas for my business. But if you prefer to use your bullet journal as a means to help you achieve a goal, like living a healthier life, for example, you could jot down activities that get you moving, plan healthy meals, and track your weekly step goals. Step 3. Make it yours. As many users as there are for the bullet journal, there are 10 times as many ways to set it up, says Shrek, who recommends starting with the following. Page numbers. Start by numbering your pages for easy reference. An index. The first page of your bullet journal should be the index. Make a list of the items you'll be tracking with your bullet journal. A weekly or daily or monthly summary. No matter how you use your bullet journal, it should be created chronologically. Because of this, creating a summary at the beginning of every week or day or month, depending on how often you plan to use it, will help you keep track of everything you want to accomplish. This could include a calendar of appointments, a series of to-dos, activity goals, or whatever serves your purpose. At the start of the next week or day or month, you can reference your summary to see what appointments were moved, what items still need to be completed, and what goals were accomplished. A tracking system for to-dos and goals. Come up with a series of symbols or marks that indicate the status of your to-do items. I put a square next to every item on my to-do list. When I finish the task, I fill in the square. If it's in progress, I put a slash through it. If it needs to be moved to the next page, I put an arrow in it. And if it no longer needs to be done, I simply cross it out. For easy reference, it's helpful to include a key to the symbols on your index page. Besides these four items, options abound. Think about what kind of lists will help you boost productivity, improve mental clarity, or achieve a goal. Some ideas for additional pages include a meal planning guide, a mood tracker, a sleep log, a bucket list, and a gratitude list. Want more guidance? Check out Mesmerizing Hyperlapse Tutorial. Step 4. Step back, admire, and get to work. As soon as you have your page numbers and index created, dive right in with a summary of your first week. Don't stress about plotting out everything perfectly on your first go. Done is better than perfect, says Shrek. The truth is, you're never going to know what works for you until you start. We're in relationships now. The 4 rules of a book group that can survive the apocalypse. On Monday, March 18, 2013, a cold, sleeting, late winter morning in New York City, my friend Hillary woke at 3 a.m. to find that the building next to hers was engulfed in flames. Fleeing apartment with her husband, twin 10-year-olds, and infant daughter, dodging fire trucks and trudging through slush, she sought refuge at a friend's place. And yet, 16 hours later, 15 women climbed several flights of stairs to Hillary's apartment. The elevator was out of commission because of the fire. Knocked on the door, and soon were passionately discussing Naguib Mahfouz's novel Palace Walk, while dining on braised lamb, sautéed eggplant, and a frisky cauliflower pomegranate salad. In spite of the sharp scent of smoke that still hung in the air, in spite of the sheets of plywood nailed to the living room wall, firemen had put them up to keep the blaze from spreading, Hillary had not considered canceling book club. Infernos come and go, but book club is forever. I started book club, we never came up with a zippier name, to solve 2 problems. The first had to do with books, period. For some time, I've been reviewing nonfiction for the New York Times Book Review, and when other editors began asking me to write reviews too, I always said yes. I regarded it as a privilege to be asked to write anything under my own name, and I still do, an attitude that my landlord appreciates, the first of every month. As stimulating as it was to tackle these assignments, and as much as I enjoyed discovering new authors and tussling with thought-provoking ideas, my leisure time was increasingly swallowed by books. I found more enjoyable to write about them than to read. The reading trances I remembered from my teens and younger years when I would lose track of hours and days, utterly caught up in Charlotte Bronte's stumbling through my paper route, reading Stendhal's The Red and the Black, had vanished. Now I found myself racing toward the finish line, longing for the book to end. The reason for this, I saw, was that I was primarily reading not because I wanted to, but because I had to. This was an unwelcome feeling. Books are my home, the place where I feel known. When I was 5 years old, my mother typed up a reading list for me of books she thought I would like, suggesting 1 classic a week, starting with Laura Ingalls Wilder, E. Nesbitt, Johann David Weiss, and Robert Louis Stevenson, and gradually advancing to Austen, Dickens, Gogol, Flaubert, Orwell, Hemingway, Napalm, and even Thor Heyerdahl. Kon-Tiki, his accent of the perilous ocean voyage he made on a balsa wood raft to test the theory of ancient continental migration. Week after week, year after year, I leaped to read each title without question. Later, she made similar lists for my little brothers, but they just shrugged and went off to play Little League. Eventually, I ventured beyond the list, raiding my parents' shelves for books by John Irving, Anne Tyler, Tom Robbins, John Updike, P.J. Wodehouse, Dostoevsky, Chekhov, and Tolstoy. My father was a Russian literature professor. When I think back to my girlhood, I remember the lyric by the songwriter Melanie, whose records my mother played. Wish I could find a good book to live in. I lived in so many good books that I felt like a citizen of numberless fictional nations. How awful it was then to realize that although I sometimes lucked out and got to review a book I loved, I mostly felt like the captive of a single literary country, a police state called required reading. There was a second problem. I needed book club to fix, too. As so many times before, I found myself emerging from a long relationship that had ended painfully. My boyfriend had been possessive, as had I, during our 2 years together. My social sphere had narrowed. I felt lonely after the breakup, not only because of the loss of the man, but also because I had let my close, interconnected circle of women friends melt away. I realized a woman who doesn't have female friends is a woman who doesn't have friends. Whenever I was single, I would promise myself that the next time I found a boyfriend, I wouldn't let love shunt friendships to the side. Meeting someone new, I'd inevitably forget. Would I never learn? I yearned to repopulate my world, but the women I knew were incredibly busy. Some of us were single, some were engaged, some had husbands, some had babies, and time was precious, much more than it had been just a few years earlier. It was getting increasingly hard to grab a quick coffee or drink, repeatedly postponed with a friend. The thing I thought was to invent an excuse that would allow a group of us to gather regularly. We would choose a book to read and fix a time on our calendars that we could look forward to and plan around. Not everyone would make every meeting, except me, but over time, as we talked about literature, we would become reoccurring characters in each other's lives, part of the same story. Reader, it worked. Inspired by the parties I remembered my mother regularly hosting for the clever, sparkling people she knew and their husbands, I invited half a dozen friends to the first book club gathering. The pattern was set that we'd have followed ever since. One member is the host and serves a light meal, often themed to the book we have read. Then, during the first hour, as members straggle in, we catch up. Once we have a quorum, we sit down to eat and for an hour discussing the book. Generally, we are exhilarated, both by our discussion, including our disagreements. It almost never happens that we all like the book. I think The Dud Avocado by Elaine Dundy is the only one of the scores of books we've read that met with unanimous approval. At the end, we decide which book to read next, many of us chipping in with ideas. Usually I suggest Balzac's Cousin Bet, and everyone refuses it. Or someone suggests Henry James, and I pretend to consider it. Once we've thinned the list, we have a vote. Now we have 24 members, who have been joined along the way by 30 children, and a dozen odd satellite members whom fate capriciously removed from book club, New York City, and in some cases North America, but who remain part of our indestructible friendship. Really, I'm amazed we've kept book club going so long. Many times a snafu arose that I thought would sink us, but it never did. There was the time when I overambitiously assigned the 1,000-page novel The Brothers Karamazov, which I wanted to revisit, having last read it at 14. As the hostess, my friend Sarah began serving borscht and Russian food. One after the other of us guilty confessed we hadn't actually managed to read it. Only one guest, a brand new member, had finished it. Another time, trying to be serious-minded after we had spoiled ourselves with a spate of novels, we picked a Pulitzer Prize-winning nonfiction book, Guns, Germs, and Steel. After 10 minutes of awkward discussion, mined with long pauses, it turned out we had nothing to say but, "Yep, that's definitely a persuasive argument." These and other near disasters have taught me four crucial rules of book club that can survive the apocalypse. The first is never choose a book unless at least one person in the club has already read it. When a group of people carve out the time to explore a book together, they want to be sure it deserves their attention and will generate lots of discussion. Not every member might like the choice. Disagreements and controversial picks make conversation sing, and sometimes bracingly sting, but there's no fun in a pile-on. To avoid picking a punching bag of a book, make sure that it has at least one defender before you enter it in the bout. The second rule seems obvious, but I can't tell you how long it took us to learn it. Try not to assign a book over 400 pages. Do you remember Laura Ingalls Wilder teaching stint in These Happy Golden Years? When her pupils balked at their homework because they thought there were too much of it, she solved the problem by reducing the number of pages they had to read. "How many do you think you can learn?" she asked one foot-dragger. "Would three be too much?" she asked. "No," he said. Eventually, he himself volunteered to tackle more pages. To head off mutiny in your book club, consider the page count. Even if you have a month before your next meeting, your readers probably won't open the book until a week or two beforehand, with luck. Divided into manageable chunks, 50 pages a day, they can read a 400-page book in 8 days and not feel overwhelmed. That said, your members may clamor to read a much-talked-about longer book, like The Goldfinch, or, during the Madoff crisis, the Trollope's novel about a British Ponzi scheme, The Way We Live Now. If they're motivated, they will read Doorstop, but make the next book a short one. The third rule is key. Don't freak out about the food. It's book club, not gourmet club. And finally, the simplest but most important rule, be flexible but tenacious in scheduling. Change the date, the venue, or even the book to accommodate your members. For instance, our group used to meet on Sundays, but when turnout dropped as more of us became parents and needed weekends for home time, we shifted to Mondays. And once, after several members admitted they were daunted by the selection, The Magic Mountain, we switched mid-month to a slimmer book, leaving the Atoka Station, to keep attendance from faltering. Another time, when a host had to cancel day of, a fellow member leapt in and offered her place instead. And respect the calendar. Not even a noble winner can draw a quorum to your coffee table during the Thanksgiving Hanukkah Christmas marathon. Will these rules work for you? I can't guarantee it, but they have for us. More than 100 books later, and after house fires, hurricanes, blizzards, and blackouts, national emergencies, family emergencies, and three sets of twins, our book club sails on, reading against the wind. Still in relationships, 5 signs it's time to break up with a friend. We often expect our friendships to be easy, but sometimes a breakup is inevitable. We ask the experts how to identify a friendship that has run its course. Unlike our romantic relationships, we often expect our friendships to be easy. Friendship is essential to our health and well-being. A study conducted through Flinders University in Australia even found that having close friends well into old age can help us live longer. The amount of friends you have may vary. According to Robin Dunbar, famous for Dunbar's number, the average person cumulatively has approximately 5 close friends, 15 best friends, 50 good friends, and 150 friends who would attend, say, your wedding or funeral. The size of your circle and the actual people you befriend will evolve over time, but not all friendships are meant to be. A study from Utrecht University in the Netherlands asked 604 adults about their friendships and then followed up 7 years later. They discovered that most people replaced half of their friends and only 30% of their close friends remained. So how do we know when it's time to break up with a friend? We spoke with Nedra Glover Tawab, a licensed therapist, New York Times bestselling author of Set Boundaries, Find Peace, and guest on Oprah's The Life You Want class on forgiveness, along with Danielle Bayer Jackson, a friendship coach, educator, and host of the Friend Forward podcast, about the 5 signs to look for when considering a friend breakup. You give 100%, but your friend gives 0%. Reciprocity is part of our social contract, but what happens when a friendship is nowhere near equal, meaning your needs are not being met and reciprocity is dwindling? Bayard Jackson encourages us to ask ourselves some questions. Is it possible that she's contributing in a way you haven't credited? Maybe you're overlooking something because your expectation is that she contributes in a way that mirrors your own. Also, is it seasonal or is this evidence of your entire friendship? If you find that you're the one pulling all the weight all the time, it may be a sign to break up with your friend. Your texts go unanswered, or you find yourself avoiding them. Most of us are guilty of leaving a text message or two on read or forgetting to return someone's call, but when this becomes the norm in a friendship, it may be time to give the friend the boot. This is a sign that you can't seem to make time for one another. Glover to Wobb urges us to consider who we want to make time for in our busy lives. There are just some people who really annoy us, and we don't talk about that enough, she explains. When we see their names, we think, I don't feel like being annoyed today. The way they talk about their problems, the way they blame other people is annoying to hear, so you're not going to run toward answering that person's call. There are no boundaries, or way too many. The University of Edinburgh defines personal boundaries as guidelines, rules, or limits you can create to identify reasonable, safe, and permissible ways for others to behave around you, and your response when someone steps outside those limits. They're an essential component to any successful relationship, but sometimes a friend doesn't respect boundaries. If it happens repeatedly, this can be a sign the friendship has run its course. As Glover to Wobb explains, when we have to establish so many boundaries with people that it becomes exhausting, many of us do choose to just let the relationship go. You don't want to share your wins or fails. If you can no longer trust a friend with news or secrets, the relationship may be toxic. If you have to continually do the mental labor of measuring your words, withholding information, minimizing accomplishments to either make this person comfortable or to make sure you don't become a target, it probably wouldn't be wise to remain in the relationship, explains Bayer Jackson. Women tend to harbor those kinds of fears and anxieties in their body and mind. It would be actively harmful for you to remain somewhere where you feel like you have to walk on eggshells. You've outgrown who you were in the past. Our friends are our mirrors. They reflect who we are. So what happens when we are no longer the same person we were when we started the friendship? I think it's great to have people you can reflect with, but also those relationships need to grow with you, and if not, you're just holding on to things that no longer fit, says Glover to Wobb. That's okay to revisit occasionally, but is it something that we have to maintain? I think there's a difference between maintaining a relationship and having a relationship. Before taking the plunge, ask yourself, does this friendship add value to your life? What is it missing? If you do find that your friendship is ready to come to an end, read here about how to move on from a friend breakup. We're in the book section, and this is Read the Sneak Peek from Oprah's 101st Book Club Pick. In this excerpt from The Covenant of Water, a newly graduated medical student from Scotland travels to India for a fresh start only to discover some surprises. Caste, C-A-S-T-E, 1933, Madras. Travel broadens the mind and loosens the bowels, a street vendor's lamb kebab in port said, drops Digby to his knees, confining him to his cabin for 2 days, enough time to appreciate Professor Alan Elder's parting words in Glasgow. By the time he recovers, they're out of the Suez Canal and passing through the Babu Mandeb, the Gate of Tears. This narrow strait, barely 18 miles across, connects the Red Sea with the Indian Ocean. Off one bow, he sees Djibouti, off the other, Yemen. Save for a three-month posting in London, he has spent his 25 years on Earth in Glasgow and might have spent the rest of his life there, never seeing this confluence of waters, never discovered for himself that the English Channel, the Mediterranean, the Red Sea, and the Indian Ocean, despite their individual personalities, are one. All water is connected, and only land and people are discontinuous, and in his land is a place where he can no longer stay. Under his feet, the ship is alive, making groans and sighs. He paces the deck in a broad-brimmed hat, though it can't keep the sunlight from bouncing off the water and tanning his face, highlighting the pale, jagged scar that creases his left cheek from the corner of his mouth to his left ear. The shifting moods and colors of the Arabian Sea, azure, blue, and black, mirror the ebb and flow of his thoughts. The horizon rises and then dips. The salt spray is cool on his face. He has the sensation of standing still while plunging toward his future. He peeks into a first-class stateroom, ashamed of his curiosity, yet awed by the sofas and plush chairs, the thick brocade curtains and the pocket doors that allow valets and maids to attend to their employers. A Maharaja's on board. He and his retinue have booked all of first-class Digby. All of first class. Digby is one class below, with his own tiny cabin. There are two classes below his, the segregation so complete that he hears rather than sees them. A rough sea brings on what is either seasickness or a relapse of the ailment from the lamb kebab. Being a doctor means he has no objectivity about his symptoms. When he's absent from the dining room for two seatings, Banerjee, who has sat at the same table, comes to check on him. Alarmed to see that Digby is barely able to lift his head, Banerjee returns with broth and perjoric. The tincture's camphor and anise odor settles in the cabin and quietens his stomach. Banerjee, or Banny, as he's asked Digby to call him, is in his late 20s, baby-faced, with the complexion of a boy raised on milk and cream, with meat never having touched his palate. His light brown skin, which he assiduously protects from the sun, is fairer than the tanned Digby's. Banny seems too young to be the barrister he is, called to the bar after 4 years of study in London. The path he has taken is much like Gandhi's at the tail of the previous century, an observation Banerjee makes quietly but with pride. When Digby rejoins the dinner table, Mrs. Anne Simmons, the wife of a district collector in the Madras Presidency, says, "Duck tonight," as if unaware of Digby's previous absence. Her wide face has no edges, no angles. She reminds Digby of a bulldog, and has the moist, sagging eyes to match. From their first day, she took command of their table, acting like a stateroom passenger, choosing to dine with the masses out of her largesse. Listening to her hold forth, as he has every night, Digby is reminded of his three-month posting at St. Bart's Hospital in London, the prize for a medical exam he topped in Glasgow in his third year of medical school. Until he got into the Bart's wards, he wasn't aware that he had an accent, or that it made others assume that he was provincial and stupid. It was a rude awakening. He couldn't shed the accent entirely, but one could soften it. He had worked hard to stay clear of those words or phrases or pronunciations that typecast him. Not that such efforts have fooled Mrs. Simmons, who largely ignores him. Now he overhears her say to the diner across from her, "We English know what's best for India. When you get there, you'll see." Later that night, Digby strolls the deck with Banny. Despite the bond they've formed, they have discussed politics. Digby confesses his ignorance of the world outside of Glasgow or even outside of the hospital. "I lived in the infirmary these last few years. I had no cause to read a newspaper unless it appeared under a wound dressing or in a belly I was opening." He's been making up for it by studying the papers in the ship's library. The headlines are about Germany's intention to rearm despite the Treaty of Versailles. A belligerent new chancellor promises to lead the country out of its economic devastation, but there's little news of India. "You could ask Mrs. Simmons." "No, thank you," Digby says. Banny smiles, polishing his lenses and squinting at Digby. "Why go to India, Digby?" Digby sees clouds in the distance, arranged as though along a plumb line. He imagines land beyond. They're alongside the west coast of India, passing Calicut or Cochin.
"Long story, Banny, I'm afraid. I fell in love with surgery. I was a good student, then a good houseman in surgery. Eager. Dedicated. When I wasn't on duty, I loitered in casualty, hoping to scrub in on accident cases. But when it came time to be selected for a surgical postgraduate post in Glasgow, turns out I wasn't in the right pew. Outside of Glasgow, there wasn't a chance. So I joined the Indian Medical Service, hoping to develop as a surgeon."
"Being a Catholic, was that it? How did they know?" Banerjee asks. "Your name?"
"No. Mine could be Protestant or Catholic. No, now Patrick or Timothy or David would be a giveaway, but I'd gone on scholarship to St. Aloysius College, a Jesuit institution. I could hardly hide that. But even without that, it's as if I'm giving out secret signals."
Digby looks at his companion uncertainly. "I'm sure it's hard to understand." Banerjee laughs.
"Not at all. It's quite familiar."
Digby is embarrassed. It's a stupid thing to say to a man who has lived under the yoke of British rule from birth, but Banny can sound and seem more British than Digby.
"I'm sorry."
"Why be sorry, Digby? You're the victim of a caste system. We've been doing the same thing to each other in India for centuries. The inalienable rights of the Brahmins and the absence of any rights for the untouchables, and all the layers in between. Everyone who is looked down on can look down on someone else, except the lowest. The British just came along and moved us down a rung." The ship rounds the southern tip of India and heads up the Coromandel coast. At midnight, Digby stands alone on deck. The black waves turn a fluorescent green and blue, as if a fire rages deep in the ocean. He's the only witness to an utterly beautiful yet mysterious spectacle. Only the next day does he learn from the steward that it was phosphorescent plankton, a rare sight. It seems to underline for Digby that he has, in the course of this voyage, peeled off his past like a soiled glove. more so than ever. He has shed a Glasgow shattered by the great slump, shed its patter, shed his last living relative, shed everything but the festering wound it left on him. The only industry that thrived in Glasgow was violence. It bubbled out of the gorbals, behind the infirmary, and from elsewhere in the city. It showed up in the casualty ward every night. As a houseman, Digby sewed faces that had been expertly sliced by the wearing razor gangs, the Billy Boys or Norman Conks, always a symmetrical pair of slashes hooking up from the corners of the mouth to the ears, marking the victim for life with a Glasgow smile. Digby feels fortunate that his own scar is just one-sided. The smashed bottle was duller than a razor and left him with a jagged dimple next to his natural one. It is a pale stigma of a life he wants to forget. He could have forgiven Glasgow his scar, his disappointments, his mother's suicide. That was hardly reason to leave. Even misery, when a familiar, has its own comfort. What he couldn't forgive was that after all his slaving, after his singular and almost maniacal devotion to surgery, he'd come to the manned door and was denied the password. His mentor, Professor Elder, a man beyond caste, albeit from upper caste Edinburgh, did his best to help, suggesting a way out. I know a place where you'll get tremendous experience, and with luck find great mentors in surgery. Have you considered the India Medical Service? What fur ye won't kabai ye, Digby thinks. It was a phrase his mother would use. Whatever is in his destiny will come to him, regardless. When he disembarks in Madras, he feels he's arrived on a new planet. The city has a population of 600,000, and most of them are at the quay, or so it appears to Digby from the cacophony, the confusion, and the heat. He breathes in the odors of cured leather, cotton, dried fish, incense, and salt water, the top notes of the antique scent of this ancient civilization. Stevedores pour from the ship's hold like a column of ants, bend forward from the weight of gunny sacks held over a shoulder with a grappling hook, sweat glossing their black skins. Women clustering outside customs make a bouquet of bright green, orange, and red saris with bold patterns. He's entranced by the punctuation of a glittering stone in the nose, a red dot on a gleaming forehead, gold dangling from the ears and echoing the heavy borders of the fabrics. The rickshaws and carriages lined up outside are painted in every color of the rainbow. The vibrant, uninhibited palette of Madras is a revelation. Something clenched within him unwinds. In the custom shed, he watches Miss Anne Simmons greet a small but stocky man, presumably her husband, the district collector. Little joy is evinced by either party at this reunion. She marches off to a small car, her chin in the air, her stubby nose pointed in the directions of Westminster, and with a royal's expression on her face. "Oi, I said no, you insolent babu. Do you want a thrashing?" Digby swivels around to see a red-faced Englishman rise from behind a custom desk to loom over Banerjee. The tableau sends a chill through him, a wrenching recognition that he is, by virtue of arrival, one of the occupiers. He is the inalienable right to be first off the gangway, receive a quick stamp of his papers, and not to be talked to in this manner. In the humid custom shed, the hands of the clock have paused, waiting to see what's next. Digby's breath quickens in the hothouse air, and reflexively he takes two steps to intervene. Just then, another customs official intercedes. All Banerjee seeks is to disembark for the 12 hours that the ship is berthed, so he can visit a friend in Madras before continuing north to Calcutta. The senior official gives his subordinate an impatient look, stamps Banerjee's papers, and lets him leave. Banny's gaze falls on Digby. His hooded eyes have turned hard as stone, expressing the dogged resentment and the unwavering resolve of a subjugated nation that bides its time. Then the look vanishes. He bestows a stoic smile on Digby and heads for the separate exit for non-whites. He doesn't wave farewell. This is from The Insiders. Oprah wants you to breathe easier. Happy Sunday to you all. You know, we're moving into a month of celebrating and maintaining well-being and longevity. Of course, all wellness and well-being begins and ends with our breath. It's amazing how we take for granted the 22,000 breaths a day we take. That's the average we take in daily. Can you believe that? You never think about it. So I was thinking, let's have a moment to say thank you for 22,000 breaths that we take for granted. Thank you for each breath. Now take a moment and do a little exercise with me. Take in a deep breath in through your nose and let your belly expand. Keep your hand on your abdomen, then exhale through your mouth, okay? That's how you're supposed to do it. Your belly expands when you're taking it in, and then you blow it out. Many times I will pause and recenter myself with three of these deep inhales and exhales. When we breathe with conscious effort as a part of a breathwork practice, the benefits are exacting. This is because doing breathwork decreases anxiety and stress and can help lower your blood pressure. It helps improve your digestion, your muscle function, and everything, really. The list goes on and on. Breathwork is so vital that we are making it the focus of this month's curriculum, which is launching on May 10th. Each month, we do a different topic. Last month, we did a deep dive into menopause. That was so rewarding because so many of you learned so much about that whole process. I thank all of you for engaging with that. For this next series, we enlist breathwork expert Robert Littman, who has a brand new book called The Breathable Body. He will be sharing exercises to help us find peace of mind and peace of body through breathing. He's going to help us jumpstart a practice if you're new to breathwork or enhance what you already are doing. As he explains, as we age, our breath flows less freely. It is compromised by everything from fear to past traumas. His mission is to help us restore a healthy breathing rhythm, which brings awareness to your inner landscape and helps identify blocks and unprocessed traumas. I hope you'll join us on May 10th, and I hope you'll breathe easier this week. Go well. We have a couple of Oprah's favorite things, Warmies Heatable Stuffed Animals. They're $22 at Amazon. Here's a soothing gift for the young and not so young. Pop one of these stuffed animals into the microwave to warm it up, then cuddle its weighted body and inhale the scent of lavender. They're great for stress or tummy aches. And we have Archive Bubble Bath, $52 at Amazon. Something I know for sure is that you need a generous pour of bubble bath for the best tub experience. I've picked Marco Elena's bubble baths a few times before because the extra large glass bottles are so gorgeous. This year's blends smell of grapefruit and neroli, green tea and willow, and rose hip and lavender. And Citrine Monterey Prep Bowls, $52 at Amazon. These nesting bowls are well-crafted and the neutral color will go in any kitchen. They even come with a handy spout to make pouring pancake batter or anything else easy to do without drips or spills. And a Totally Bamboo Family Tree Carving Board, $90 at Amazon. Want to know what I said the first time I laid eyes on this carving board? Yes, yes, yes. Not only is this tree etching display worthy, it serves a purpose. It directs juices away from meat you're carving and into a larger well. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.